I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. It's listener-supported community radio, and it is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this November 21st Monday. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. This morning on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick interviews Larry Kleinman about Latinos organizing to stop Trumpism. They discuss the potentials long-term to go on a great offensive to make clear to all, including the white working class at every level, that we are, quote, in the same boat, brother, as Leadbelly said himself, and must fight for good jobs for all. And Larry Kleinman is co-founder of the Oregon Farm Workers Union, PACOON. The Left and the Law with Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker will do a post-mortem on the election, focusing on Trump's proposed appointment of for Attorney General, Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, and what that means for criminal justice reform. And spoiler alert, it's pretty bad. Mike and Jan will focus specifically on Sessions' bills previously introduced in the Senate to crack down on sanctuary cities throughout the U.S., and they will also be talking about the sanctuary movement as critical sites of resistance to Trump's law and order politics. I will be talking this morning with Stephanie Luce, professor of labor studies at the Joseph S. Murphy Center, City University, New York, and we'll discuss post-election results as they relate to labor, minimum wage campaigns, and the importance of mass protests now in the wake of a Trump victory, and how they can shape social movements going forward. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members old and new for supporting KBOO programs like the Old Mole Variety Hour. And remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And we're leading off this morning with Stephanie Luce on the phone. Stephanie, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you for switching things around this morning. We're working out some technical issues, and we'll have Bill Resnick's interview at the end of the program. Stephanie, you are in a labor studies program, and I thought maybe folks might want to know what kind of work you're doing there. You have a long history, actually, as an activist and a movement builder as well, in working around living wage campaigns, and you've written a couple of books, Fighting for a Living Wage, 2004. And also, remind me of the second book. My notes are a little scrambled at the moment. Ah, here we go. Labor Movements, Global Perspectives, 2014. So you're busy and fighting the good fight, but you also teach in a very interesting department.
Sure. The labor studies program I teach in includes a master's degree, as well as an undergraduate degree in urban and community studies that has an emphasis on labor. And we run something called Union Semester for undergrads and students who have already graduated. And basically, this is just these are classes for people who want to learn more about the labor movement in the broad sense. So it's not just unions, it's worker centers or working class movements and social movements in the U.S. and globally. So I teach things like labor and globalization, labor economics, theories of the labor movement, that kind of thing. So it's a lot of fun.
So in your work, you deal a lot with looking at the importance and power of unions, and you have already been thinking along the lines of what it's going to take going forward. But what's kind of important and somewhat getting lost is that life for working people in the United States has not been good for a long time. And that includes problems inside unions as well as the pressures outside of the unions. So I wanted to kind of start there and get your insights in terms of how unions may have participated in this unfortunate end of this election, because many unions really ran to the gate to support Clinton, while there were some notable departures there, particularly the postal unions. But union leadership was really on board with Clinton and some pretty unfortunate economic policies.
Yeah, I think the trick of this election is thinking about going back to the last 20, 30, 40 years and seeing that the Democrats have not been a friend to working people on many fronts. So whether it's the promoting trade agreements like NAFTA and Trans-Pacific Partnership, a lot of Democratic leadership has been very reluctant to raise minimum wages. And many have stood by while unions have been very much under attack and not really said anything. So the Democratic Party has been a problem. It hasn't been a party of labor. And there was no signs that that was going to change under Hillary Clinton. At the same time, the unions have, for the most part, continued to cling to the Democratic Party, offering more and more money, staff time, you know, get out the vote efforts, really putting all their eggs in the Democratic Party basket. And, you know, like you said, that's not true across the board. There was larger unions like the Communication Workers of America that were very active in the Bernie Sanders campaign. But once Clinton got the nomination, the labor movement really didn't have a lot of other, you know, strategies other than working to get her elected. And unfortunately, you know, her issues and her track record just don't speak to a lot of working people. People were pretty discouraged, and a lot of people reported, hey, with Clinton, we're just going to keep getting more of the same. The same has been bad. The same has been, you know, low wages, high underemployment, precarious work. And some people said, well, at least with Trump, we don't know what we're getting. There's a chance it could be better. So the unions have a lot of work to do in terms of building an alternative strategy, how to bust out of this two-party system and this focus on electoral work and really reconnect with a lot of working people, not just their members, but, you know, the working class more broadly, around building a political movement that can represent those kinds of politics.
I think probably talking a little bit about right to work would be a good place to go, considering that there was a victory and a defeat, and I'll have you remind me what states those were. But there were right to work. I want you to talk about what right to work is, so all of our listeners are able to understand really what that legislation is. Because on the other end of that, with the unions needing to do so much work to regroup and the rank and file needing to put pressure on leadership, on the outside, we may be looking at a Scott Walker, Secretary of Labor situation in which a right to work national law could be on their wish list.
Right, right. And I think in the more general terminology, both, you know, in terms of the private sector right to work and what we've, you know, people talk about the Friedrichs case for the public sector. Really what the opposition has, you know, people that are opposed to unions have been trying to do is make it that so that it's much harder for unions to require people to pay dues while being covered by the union. So, for example, right now, whether or not you want to be in some states, if you want to be in the union or not, you could be a member or not, but you're still paying dues for the services that the union provides. The union negotiates a collective bargaining agreement that gives you higher wages and benefits, and it also gives you legal protection. And in return, you are paying dues to the union for that service. We've seen increasingly states around the country making that illegal to do that. And, you know, in reality, that momentum was likely to continue no matter who was elected, because that's been on the agenda. With a Trump presidency, it seems like you both do the Supreme Court changes in the administration, changes in the National Labor Relations Board. It looks like we could face a lot of that legislation just coming much more quickly or all at once at the federal level. Now, some people think that in the labor movement think, well, that's a problem, but it's not our worst problem, because what it means is that you go back to a situation where only those workers who really want to be in the union, who are pro-union, are in the union. And otherwise, the union has to go out and knock on doors or go to each workplace and talk to each worker and say, this is why you should be in the union and this is why you should pay dues. So, but what it means is if these kinds of laws pass, it dramatically decreases union membership in places like Wisconsin. It decreases union treasuries, reduces the number of organizers that can be hired. So it'll be a pretty serious blow if we can base, you know, if we can look to places like Wisconsin and Michigan and see the impact of those kinds of laws.
And Trump has a pretty good sized list of actions he wants to take regarding labor. One of them, interestingly, and I've already had conversations with people about this, is this proposed hiring freeze on all federal employees to reduce federal workforce through attrition. And on the one hand, I've heard people saying, well, we need, you know, people have this perception that there's all of this excess labor in government agencies, and this might seem somewhat appealing to them. But my thought is this is really a backdoor to further destroy public workers and the public sector unions.
Absolutely. I mean, it's another way to also look to privatize some of this work, like GSA agents and in the Postal Service. So there's nothing, there's very little fat on the federal employment level. These are people who provide services that we need. And it's just such a small percentage of the budget anyways. It doesn't even make sense as a monetary attack. You know, I think what's interesting about Trump's proposals for his first, you know, agenda is that, you know, there's some unions and working people that are going to look at that list and say, hey, some of that sounds pretty good. Most notably, stopping the Trans-Pacific Partnership and renegotiating NAFTA. Interestingly enough, those are promises Obama ran on. Obama ran on the promise of reopening NAFTA and no new trade agreements. He went back on that, you know, almost immediately. With Trump, it's hard to say, I mean, it looks already like the Trans-Pacific Partnership may in fact be dead, and that is a good thing for working people, though not necessarily for the same reasons that he's for it. So, but I think that we want to, like, we're going to have to figure out how do we navigate this minefield that Trump may put forward proposals that sound good for people. For example, infrastructure projects, a lot of building trades people are going to think, hey, that's going to mean jobs, but most likely what it's going to mean is, you know, giving subsidies to private employers who then hire, you know, low-wage workers with very bad working conditions. There's no guarantee this is going to mean good jobs for people, and there's no guarantee it's going to mean good infrastructure either. So we need to be careful about how we relate to some of the proposals that might go through related to labor that might seem good.
Right. And you actually went exactly where I wanted to go with that. And in fact, you know, it seems like much of what is happening could potentially be a danger in terms of, as we are focusing on trying to beat back all of these attacks, there's going to be a lot of money to be made by some folks. And that just seems like, you know, part of the game. And this is the great Trump, you know, the great businessman Trump at his best, is to, you know, make lots of money off of labor. And I wanted to also note, and maybe you could talk about this, you know, as someone who's also a climate change denier, much of the infrastructure work is not going to be particularly green. It's not going to move us forward and create the kinds of jobs and kinds of meaningful jobs that we could really use in this country.
Absolutely. In fact, most likely it might be the exact opposite. So, I mean, there's so many good proposals out there about creating good jobs that are about retrofitting buildings and making buildings environmentally sustainable, about building kinds of mass transit that's good for the environment. There's so much potential that can be done there. Trump's proposals are going in the opposite direction, talking about things like making new jobs in, you know, the Keystone, you know, approving the Keystone pipeline and those kinds of jobs that are going to actually, you know, they may provide jobs, but it's a short-term job that's totally undermining the environment and creating serious divisions between the people getting those jobs and the impact on what they're going to do for people's lives.
Stephanie, I wanted to, and I'm talking to Stephanie Luce. She's a professor of labor studies at CUNY City University of New York. We're talking post-Trump and the impact on labor, and we'll get to the juicy stuff. I want to just talk a little bit about protests at the end. But before we go there, in your book, Fighting for a Living Wage, which has been a really large part of your work, is working in and writing about the living wage movement. You mention that one of the real difficulties about living wage is actually getting these ordinances to be fully realized. Mm-hmm. How do you see, in terms of where we've been and where we're going, obviously you can make an easy case for it being much more difficult, but it's mm-hmm. already been hard to get these things implemented.
Right. The work that I've mostly done so far is working with living wage, minimum wage campaigns. And I've made the argument, based on studying cities around the world, that it could be one thing to get a law passed, and it's a whole other thing to get it enforced, that we cannot look at law as the final answer. It's not like you pass a law and then you're done, that these kinds of campaigns are just part of a larger struggle and organizing project. So you pass a law, but then you need to stay organized to work with workers, to know their rights, to be able to file charges, to have other people with them to file the charges they need to get that through. And so I guess, I would say, just what is, in terms of the lessons of this election cycle, I mean, first of all, we saw one of the bright spots of this, if you could even say anything's a bright spot, was that, four new states passed minimum wage laws, minimum wage increases. Two of those include paid sick days requirements. And Flagstaff, Arizona, and Maine are also eliminating a wage for tipped workers. So the tipped workers will now be getting, phasing in a full minimum wage. So that highlights that there are issues in which, voters still really want things like higher minimum wage. They want fair trade. They want campaign finance and fair elections. So I think we can still be building movements around those things, but we have to be prepared for, it's not just about the law. It's like, just getting the law changed isn't enough. It's really about building the movements that'll make that law a reality.
And there we segue into, these mass protests that have happened around the country and questions about whether or not, for me, I think a lot about whether these protests would have happened had Hillary Clinton been elected, when in fact they need to happen, because everything that we're talking about here this morning is a factor on both ends. Whether it's going to be extremely worse under Trump, time will tell. But in terms of the protests, these kinds of actions are very important. And it's also, as you say, important then to move towards something and to be continuing to educate and focus on the great impacts of economic policy in the country, racism and immigration issues, all of it. It's a difficult task, but this isn't really about winners or losers. This is really an opportunity and a moment to try to capture that energy and bring something much more impactful forward.
Yeah. I mean, I think the protests are, I don't think it's likely these protests would have been happening if Clinton was elected. I think these are part of a reflection of people's shock and grief and fear, and a need to just be with each other, to represent that there was an alternative view out there. In fact, the majority of people that did vote voted against Trump. 70 million people voted against Trump. So I think people are wanting to have their voices heard. Fortunately, I don't think that's all we're seeing. I mean, I think the protests are healthy. They're part of democracy, but there's all kinds of organizing work going on alongside that. Reports are coming in from around the country of emergency community meetings that are overflow crowds, 500 people, 1,000 people showing up in their neighborhoods to talk about next steps. Organizations getting thousands of new members signing up, coming to meetings, money flowing in to campaign issues. So I'm encouraged by the fact that protests are good, one thing, but it's not stopping there. People are also building the infrastructure they need to go forward. And that's what we need, is we need the voices out there saying that our electoral system at the federal level is absolutely broken. You know, many people can't vote at all. 30 to 40 million people are kept from even registering. Others are not voting because they feel the candidates don't represent anything for them, no change. And we're just in a place where we don't even have the choice to vote for candidates that represent fundamental change. You know, we're facing a global economic, political, and environmental crisis, and we don't have any candidates, you know, we don't have the choice of voting for someone who's going to address those. The system is completely broken.
And indeed, and we have to really see this as a great opportunity. And some of that started with Sanders, but it does indeed need to go beyond that even. So, Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us this morning and for stepping up to the plate for the first interview of the morning, even though I know you're ahead of us a few hours. So, Stephanie Luce, Professor of Labor Studies at City University of New York, thank you again.
Thank you. Bye.
We're in the same old brother. We're in the same old brother. And if you shake one end, you're gonna rob the other. It's the same old brother.
Oh, Lordy, look down from his holy place. Say, Lord and me, what a sea of space. What's about to launch the human race? So he built him a boat for a mixed up crew, with eyes of black and brown and blue. So that's how come that you and I got just one world with just one sky.
We're in the same boat, brother. We're in the same boat, brother. And if you shake one end, you're gonna rock the other.
It's blue in her lonely slip. By barbiturate, who in these realms of love, who by something blunt, who by avalanche, who by powder, who for his greed, who for his hunger.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM. This is Denise Morse, your host this morning. I'm in studio here with The Left and the Law, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker. They've got a little post-mortem on the election for us. Jan and Mike?
Well, there's been tremendous anxiety for some time about Republican Supreme Court appointments, and the right has been quite fixated on the goal of reversing Roe v. Wade, a daunting problem in and of itself. But there's another dark figure entering the stage here of Trump's pageantry of power, and that is his appointment of Jeff Sessions as Attorney General. So let's start with this role. What does the as an attorney who navigated in this world for quite a while of the law, what does the attorney general do as the chief lawyer of the land?
A lot. The attorney general advises the president on who to appoint at not only the Supreme Court level, but at all lower levels of courts. He represents the United States, and any legal matter determines who to prosecute with a death penalty. But primarily, one of the areas where he has the most power is the area of immigration law. Because in the area of criminal justice, there is a separation of powers. There are judges appointed that any executive member has to deal with. But in the area of immigration law, he can appoint judges he likes and get rid of judges he doesn't like. He can reverse decisions made by immigration law judges.
So at various levels of the bureaucracy, he can steamroll and push things through more effectively than with the courts and the criminal justice system, where there's more sites and positions to push back from.
Yeah, for example, in 1994, your sexual gender was allowed to give you asylum if it was being persecuted in the country you came from. That was a decision made by the Attorney General. That can be reversed by the Attorney General. And Jeff Sessions is keenly interested in immigration.
He has a longer attention span than President-elect Trump, which is not necessarily a good thing, right? I mean, in and of itself, he's been interested in this for quite some time and, in fact, had submitted a Senate Bill 1640 in June of 2015 that would specifically target sanctuary cities and punish them around immigration issues. What is his strategy for dealing with immigration and fulfilling Trump's trumpeted proposals around exporting, deporting? I think he does probably think of them as imports and exports, but deporting undocumented workers.
Well, he's already written a handbook on how the U.S. should deal with immigration. It's all about curbing it. And, of course, his notions are premised on the idea that we're legally importing millions of low-wage workers while we're sustaining millions of people on welfare. That's his basic ideological slant. So he has made the most repressive laws of almost any state in Alabama, which has caused Alabama farmers and growers and some capitalists to complain down there. But he will do... he's close to Trump. He was early on the wagon in February. He supported him. He's like a conciliary. He'll be like John Mitchell was to Richard Nixon. He'll have a lot of power. And this will be, I think, an early flashpoint with the Trump regime, because even as he works hard to get rid of people he calls criminal aliens, there are not only sanctuary cities, but there are sanctuary campuses. And particularly in the West Coast, in San Jose State, and the chancellor of the California University System, where there are like 400,000 students, has said that they will not cooperate with the federal government in enforcing immigration laws. So there is a serious resistance.
But the immigrant rights movement and the sanctuary movement has been also pounded rather heavily by the Obama administration. Obama did deport something like 2.4 million people. The Secure Communities Act of a decade or so ago really pushed for local law enforcement to cooperate with ICE around immigration policies, and many police departments, including the U.S., including here in Portland, have developed policies to not report, for example, a person who is picked up and booked in a jail, reporting them to immigration. So I think it's also important not to set this regime as a complete departure from what has been happening in recent decades.
It's cleaner, Jen. I mean, Obama was an engaging guy, but he was a neoliberal to his core. And so that made it confusing to oppose him or any of his policies, because it might blunt another policy that you like. But none of that ambiguity is present here. It will be Trump attempting to categorize everyone from another country as a criminal alien. And it will be sanctuary cities and students who are seeing them as fellow students, as people studying medieval history next to them in class. It will be people working in cities. And there is a history of a sanctuary cities and sanctuaries from the early 80s, when the wars that we were supporting in Central America led to refugees who at first found a safe space in churches, but then that expanded to cities. So,
which can include not just not participating with ICE, but also providing access to services and other forms of support to undocumented workers.
That's right. It's a fuzzy notion. The sanctuary, it can be at minimum not cooperating with ICE or the Federal Enforcement Bureau, and maximum it can be consciously providing city services to them as would any other resident, treating them as residents, equal residents.
And I think now one effect under the Obama administration was this idea that oppressed groups, people of color, poor people, homeless people, were the vulnerable ones who needed sanctuary. And I think now there is some sense that there aren't that many places of sanctuary from this regime that has very much bared its teeth. And so there may be a common ground around different levels of vulnerability. Some groups are far more vulnerable and apt to be targeted, but a sense of, as social classes that do not own the apparatus of power are not the owning classes, some potential forms of solidarity that go beyond some of the discourse of sanctuary in the past that is only taking in those that are vulnerable. Many of us are vulnerable now.
Well, it's also a regional difference. You know, the West Coast massively voted against Trump. Much of these early and articulate expressions of resistance come from people in power in the West Coast. The West Coast not only buried Trump in the elections, but they supply tens of billions of dollars in extra taxes, that more than they get back in federal funds. So the West is not without power, and it'll be very interesting to see how regional opposition, along with class opposition and social opposition, fares.
One worry around the sanctuary movement is the potential for mobilizing the urban-rural divide in ways that are really destructive, and it's a worrisome aspect to even some of the left rhetoric or progressive rhetoric that casts rural people as inherently backward, that cities are where it's at. And Sessions is very good at mobilizing that, these West Coast cities, the Sodom and Gomorrahs on the hill, you know, that I think it's also important to note how many rural areas also have provided sanctuary spaces, and small towns are on the map of, so it's not just the big city on the hill or on the West Coast, which, and our economies may not depend on the base as much as those places that have been so devastated economically in this country.
Well, we need to make those alliances where they can be made. You know, there's a natural and timeless almost opposition between rural areas and the cities.
Partly it's very old.
I know. The cities set the prices for the goods produced, you know, the trees, the food. So there's a natural opposition, but it will always be there to some degree, but to the extent that it can be blunted around an area where there are many common interests, for example, where rural economies are supported, meat packing areas by immigrants. So it's not necessarily total opposition all the time, particularly on this issue.
Yeah, and so what, just in our last few minutes, what about on the criminal justice front, where you've been very active? Where do you see the sites of resistance there? You're saying it cannot just appoint, dismantle all the courts, but he can do quite a lot, and this regime can do quite a lot.
Well, yeah, and early, you know, let's take a moment to note positive results from the election. The marijuana won in a rout. It's prevailed in several states, and now it's no longer the easy bust, which will primarily affect African Americans.
You were saying in our last segment that this often it's the entry drug to the criminal justice system, because it's easy to bust people on that.
Exactly.
On marijuana.
And although consumption is equal across races, the arrests are four times more likely if you're African American. So that's a good thing. But what will happen at the national level, since marijuana is still illegal? You know, there was a memorandum written in 2013 by the Justice Department that basically told the states that we won't intervene. If you can do whatever you want, but the law remains on the books. It's possible for the federal government to reinstitute the illegality of marijuana and to challenge states and to actually arrest people. Now, I don't think that'll happen because there's so many votes in favor of it in so many places now. But that's a possibility. And there are other areas of discretion. Whenever there's within the Attorney General's office that are going to create problems, It will not be the kind of flashpoint I think that immigration law will be, because there are judges and there are prosecutors and defense, and there's a tremendous inertia within the criminal justice system. But Sessions is eager and alert. He's got friends, and he will be busy.
And has some allies among Democrats who've brought out his support for equalizing penalties for crack cocaine and powder cocaine. What do you think about that? That defense of it's as though one has to be thoroughly 100% a villain in order to be cast a villain. The bar seems pretty low in this case, but he apparently does have allies across the aisle, as they say.
Well, he has. In 1986, he was rejected by a Republican judicial committee for a position of a district court judge because of racist remarks he had made in the past. He's worked diligently to overcome that. He nominated Rosa Parks for a Congressional Medal. He makes gestures toward equality, but
apparently he's quite gentlemanly in some ways in his manner. You know, that can be very seductive, I guess, versus Trump.
Well, I think he's going to be a person, a formidable enemy to the interests that people who listen to this radio show share, precisely because I won't say he's seductive, but he doesn't foam at the mouth. You know, he talks reasonably, but he's very intent primarily on stopping all immigration, of characterizing people as illegal, as criminals.
And even the notion of what is criminal becomes itself a kind of political discourse that's up for grabs. How you define a criminal.
He's very aware of that, and he will define it very broadly, and it will punish great swaths of people who are not currently being threatened.
Yeah. Like the old line, we are all legal. I think we should embrace this. We are all illegal on a certain level. I'm going to embrace it and fight back. So this is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking today about the appointment of Jeff Sessions as Attorney General. And we've got our work cut out for us, right?
That's right.
I finally broke into the prison. I found my place in the chain. Even damnation is poisoned with rainbows. All the brave young men are waiting now to see a signal which some killer will be lighting for pay.
That's our dearly departed Leonard Cohen with Old Revolution. I recommend the full listening to that song. Well, we're wrapping up this morning with Bill Resnick interviewing Larry Kleinman here on the Old Mole. They'll talk about Latinos organizing to stop Trumpism. Bill.
Larry Kleinman, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill. Great to be here again.
Larry Kleinman, along with many others, the principals were Cipriano Farrell and Ramon Ramirez. They co-founded PICUN, Oregon's tree planter and farm workers movement and union. They organized mostly migrant workers, such that PICUN became one of Oregon's and the nation's leading voices and service organizations and membership activation organizations for Oregon farm workers. They are a union, they're a service agency, a Spanish and partly English radio station, a beautiful low-income housing subdivision around Woodburn, They fight for the members and all farm workers, including organizing work, picketing, bringing about court challenges, and forcing many farmers to accept union demands and greatly improve the conditions in their farms and factories and processing plants. Larry was the secretary treasurer at Picun for how many years, Larry?
25 years.
25 years. Now he has new work. Tell us about it. He's still working with Picun as an advisor, but he's also working nationally.
Right, and listeners might remember that 3 years ago, I stepped down as part of a planned generation shift of leadership. My successor is Jaime Arredondo, young farmworker family, members of Picun, kind of grew up in the movement, and he stepped in and is now the new secretary treasurer. And I moved into national work with part of a larger movement that Picun is a part of called the Fair Immigration Reform Movement. 36, mostly state, local coalitions or membership organizations fighting for immigrant rights that's existed for about 15 years, and Picun was one of the co-founders of that. My role in that national work now is as a senior advisor on strategy and capacity building to build the movement power, either through proactive opportunities like we had hoped to have under the Obama administration, or now that we are pivoting that capacity to defend the community against the threats of mass deportation.
You know, now is a wonderful time for the Latino community at every level, including the national level, to make alliances with so many other groups that are in different ways, but similarly and powerfully under attack. I know they're thinking about that in Washington and everywhere. And Black Lives Matter, for example, there's discussions amongst the leadership and the people for some kind of really larger struggle. Tell us about that.
That's right. And I think that so my work is mostly based in Washington, but I intersect with leaders from all over the country, local leaders, and also national leaders in other immigrant rights organizations or allied groups, unions, SEIU being a prime example, and other movements. So I would say to you and to the listeners that this is not a new thing, but it has a new urgency. And it has a new moment. It's because of the crisis that's come out of this election. And we are early in that thinking of what this new reality means and calls for. But we're 10 days in as of this moment. So it's very early. And the first and understandable priority for the organizations I work with is defending the community. But it's just right out there beyond people's consciousness that there are many others similarly affected. Maybe not quite on the firing line like immigrants are or seem to be in Trump's rhetoric and his priorities, but I believe that coming together that you're describing will flourish in 2017.
And there are so many groups that can be a part of that and that are now appalled and frightened and who have large memberships or at least affiliates, people who look to them for leadership, and that can be activated, it seems to me. It's not just the people in the streets now. Some of it is good. Some of it is different than what we would want. And it will strengthen. It was going to strengthen through the Trump presidency and certainly the first several hundred days. It's not clear that it couldn't become a great majority of Americans because they're taking aim at even at Social Security and Medicare now and not just sort of the weaker, often people of color groups. Look into the future a little bit. How do you see that all coming together?
Well, first of all, I think it's going to be uneven nationally. We live here on the West Coast in a zone that, and in an area of the country that I think has a more ascendant trajectory of progressive power. And there are large chunks of this country, including many places that have a relatively newly arrived immigrant or Latino population, that do not have that progressive infrastructure. They do not have a progressive political culture. In fact, there is a strong force of reaction in those places. So I think it's going to be uneven across the country. The first phase of this is, as I said a minute ago, is going to be groups taking account and coming up with the first responses of how do we defend against the initial attacks. Now, the initial attacks might not materialize as people imagine, but we have to be ready because we cannot count on anything. We cannot count on it happening or not happening. So that's the first step that the conversations I've been in the last 7 or 8 days have reflected, understandably, in the immigrant community. That means defending DACA, the Deferred Action for Children Arrivals, the so-called Dreamers, 750,000 young immigrants who have temporary work permits, all of which could be canceled on January 20th, the day that Trump is sworn in as president. All he has to do is sign an executive order to that effect. He may not do that, but that seems to be one of the key rallying points and points of initial immediate defense that people are coming together around.
Also, the sanctuary cities struggled,
That's right.
Seems to me. He has really raised the gauntlet, right, and made a promise. I'm not sure he can implement it quickly. I'm sure there'd be court cases that went at his power. But it seems to me that's going to be an important struggle, and it's going to be an important struggle to control the police, it seems to me.
Absolutely.
The police really supported Trump strongly. He'd strongly defended them against any challenge. The police unions were powerfully on his side, and they may not want to take direction from their mayors, even in liberal cities. They have a lot of discretion. They can arrest anybody they want on the streets for whatever it is. I see that as a coming struggle all over the country, actually.
I agree with that, although I'd say that, I think there's a range.
Great variety, yes.
Yeah, and
Joe Arpaio lost his election.
Arpaio was removed.
Arpaio was, yeah.
And is under criminal indictment. His trial will be December 8th on criminal contempt of court. So that was very important as an affirmation of a surge of Latino voters in Arizona, 150,000 new Latino voters registered, and especially in Maricopa County. I think you're absolutely right to call out the question of police-ICE cooperation. ICE has its sort of work plan. They can carry out large-scale raids, but large-scale raids take a long time and a lot of planning and resources. So really, the ubiquitous threat to immigrants is local police forces. And what their posture is, if their posture is aggressive, if it's enforcing immigration laws, if it's channeling people over to ICE, that's an existential threat in every community. If they're not doing that, the threat is more limited, but still very powerful. So one of the early things in the Trump administration will be to see what exact consequences they can impose by executive order in terms of funding, defunding threats on cities that maintain postures of non-cooperation between ICE and local police.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Larry Kleinman, one of the co-founders who built PICOON into an important, not just Oregon organization, protecting farm workers and especially immigrant farm workers, but a national organization that has been involved in national discussions to form united fronts amongst many Latino groups all over the country to defend the rights of immigrants and all poor people. Larry now left PICOON, although he's still an advisor for PICOON as part of a generational shift. There are new people now in PICOON. Mm-hmm. Larry's working now with the Fair Immigration Reform Movement in Washington, a very large group of Latino groups.
I think while most of the member organizations affirm state coalitions and local organizations are Latino-dominated and some Latino-led, there are a number of them that have a variety of ethnicities of immigrants, with Asian, Middle Eastern, African. So it's a broader spectrum.
Right. And you probably also include a lot of the liberal churches and various other groups somehow as working with them.
Absolutely.
If not official members.
That's right.
That's how it sort
right.
of
and
works.
Some of the organizations in firm are coalitions that have hundreds of organizations, including support organizations like you're describing.
Right. There's going to be a flurry of horrible things at the beginning, probably, unless they're really much more clever, which I think they're going to be like on trying to destroy Medicare and Social Security. They're going to chip away at it, you know, murder it by 1,000 cuts rather than going at it frontally and just trying to privatize.
Mm-hmm.
They're fairly smart. That's what they're doing with public education. They've developed a real, very good campaign for destroying public education in this country. Worked much more slowly than they thought, but they've made progress. And my guess is that in a lot of areas, they will do that. In immigration, though, they really may bring down the hammer as much as they can right at the beginning, as you pointed out. But let's talk about the longer term. It's a complicated picture, but it is true that a lot of white workers have moved from supporting Obama in two elections. For example, many, many of the counties that gave Obama his victory, gave Trump his victory, formally voted for Obama twice in his runs for president. So saying it's just racism or just anti-immigrant feelings, in fact, is not a useful analysis of why so many white working class people shifted allegiances and decided that Trump was their last hope, it seems to me. At least many of them are, it seems to me, not devoted to an alternative right or even right-wing agenda. They are desperate for help, and they're desperate for jobs, it seems to me, is the way to look at it. And their lives are extremely precarious, and they're desperate for security. Larry, it seems to me, in the long run, to build a movement that can prevail over Trumpism, a lot of those people are going to have to be won over. And I think right at the beginning, we have to be thinking about that. How do you respond to that?
Well, there's no question that there's an immense amount of work to do. There's decades of wreckage and damage in immigrant communities, in African-American communities, people of color, and in working-class communities. I think listeners of The Old Mole have heard chapter and verse over the years, those who are devoted listeners, about the stories, the analysis of the underlying causes. That work goes on. It goes on in a new reality, with a new urgency, and we are left with the complicated work, as you say, of discerning where is white supremacy now manifest in America, because it is at the heart of America. Sometimes it's very obvious and crude. Other times it's very subtle. Sometimes people express their economic insecurity in racist terms and vice versa. So we can't simply surrender to its overcomplication, even though it's true. We have to find those avenues to build common cause, and I think they will be around concrete economics at the local level. There are, for example, towns in the center part of Pennsylvania that are reviving economically because of the arrival of Dominicans and Puerto Ricans, right? Now, the traditional or historic white population in some of those towns, some of them see that, a few of them, the minority, I believe, see that as a good thing. That saying our town would have died without these folks coming in. That's repeated in rural America all over the country. Iowa, Kansas, South Dakota, even parts of Oregon, I think you could describe in those terms. There are other folks, though, that either don't see opportunity for themselves or feel there is none or feel somehow dispossessed by that phenomenon. And that's, again, where white supremacy, I think, comes in as a force, even if it's not recognized by the expressor of it. So I think the day-to-day work of relationship building and realignment is really, I think, at the heart of what you're talking about as it relates to immigrant communities.
It is possible, though, to reach out much more widely than we imagine, that at least we have, to talk to those people and bring them even, I mean, you're not going to convince people right away. They don't move. That's not how politics works. One discussion at in a shopping mall or in front of a Walmart, or even giving people some materials. But over time, Trumpism is going to disappoint, as you pointed out earlier in one of our discussions. Mm. Trump doesn't have a program for those people. And indeed, nor does international capital and the globalizers and the elites have programs for those people, and are not willing to give up their privileged positions in order to accommodate all of those needs, and are not ready to provide the resources that would be required to respond to global warming or to the failing of infrastructure in the United States. How can we, though? It seems to me at some point, though, we have to incorporate them within the coalition, at least win many of them over, who could be won over to a very vicious, nationalistic, racial set of forces.
Well, and sometimes when we think about this, we think about imagining what turning the tide in a given city or town or even state would look like, which then when we unpack, it seems really daunting. So I would just commend the work of groups like the Rural Organizing Project, who have set themselves to this exact kind of task now for 25 years almost, starting with issues of gender identity and sexual orientation. That was the initial conversation spawned by the anti-gay lesbian ballot measures in the 90s. But I think they've made serious connections in rural Oregon and have a deep understanding of how those dynamics are actually playing out, not how we imagine they're playing out from the outside. And again, and as we see often in politics, as you say, the loudest voices often get the most attention, but they're not necessarily representative. And so the occupation that played out in Harney County is a great example, where you had a divided community. And most folks in that community were saying, we don't want you here. We don't want the alt-right here. We don't want the armed right here. We don't want the militias here. That's not who we are. That is not addressing our problems that are facing us in this community. So I think there's simply not enough investment in that work by national funders. And one larger problem we have, I think, for the organizing world and the social change world is the billionarization of philanthropy, where billionaires increasingly are providing the resources, not millionaires, not longstanding endowments that are run by professional program officers. And these billionaires fund work in a billionaire kind of way, and it overlooks entire sectors, social sectors, geographic sectors of this country. And so we end up with the disinvestment. We have an economic disinvestment in those communities, and we have a philanthropic disinvestment, and we have an organizing disinvestment, right? Which is largely about capacity, I would argue, not will or desire.
We can predict what the future is going to look like, and it's going to be a lot of defense, and it's going to have to include a lot of rethought offense, that is going out and organizing counter communities. And in fact, it's not just giving them a leaflet. It is in some ways building organizational strength in those communities. I'm sure you agree. Why don't you take the last word?
So I just say quickly to folks that turn your anger and your anguish into a commitment for action. Start with coming out. There'll be probably mass mobilizations across the country on the 14th of January. That's the Saturday of MLK weekend. I'm sure there'll be one in Oregon. Go out of your way to respond to that. We need to send a strong signal before Trump is inaugurated, and we're going to need especially lawyers to defend immigrants. We're going to need all kinds of things, but we have to pick ourselves up and set ourselves on a path of resistance and rebuilding, building on a lot of what we already have. But the first order of business is, for in the work I do, is defend immigrants.
Larry Kleinman, thanks so much for talking
Thank
to
you,
us
Bill.
Again. It's always really great to talk to you.
Same.
Indeed. Thank you all for joining us this morning on the Old Mole Variety Hour. Let me tell you that the KBOO Evening News produces a one-hour newscast every weeknight. We need writers, editors, reporters, and more to make this grassroots community resource happen. If you are interested, training free of charge, contact Lisa Loving by email at newsdirector@kboo.org. I'm Denise Morris. Patricia Kohlberg has been our engineer this morning. Thanks. We'll see you next week.